Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm so excited to have the writer, producer, showrunner, Veena Sood here.
Very excited to be here.
Ah, Veena, we're over here on the east side.
Yes.
Somehow
yes,
an easy
so
commute.
Nice.
It's wonderful.
So nice.
For those of you guys who aren't familiar with Veena's work, please allow me to introduce her. Veena Sood began her career as a journalist working for Pacifica Radio and the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Eventually, she enrolled in and graduated from NYU's Graduate Film and Television program before getting a gig directing for The Real World. A lot of folks love that show. She then moved to Los Angeles and put in her time as a rookie writer staffed on the CBS police procedural Cold Case, where she was promoted by, I think, third season, she was promoted to showrunner.
Oh, actually, I'm sorry. Fourth season.
Oh, you know what? It's still like head of the class, we'll say. So by fourth season, she was promoted to showrunner. And from there, she developed and created The Killing for AMC and Netflix now. Adapted from a Danish TV series, The Killing follows two detectives in Seattle, Washington, as they attempt to solve homicides. The show was nominated for 6 Emmys, including a nomination for Veena's writing, as well as a WGA nomination for Best New Series. And she was featured in The Hollywood Reporter's 2011 Power Showrunners list and Variety's Women's Impact Report. Her newest TV series is called 7 Seconds, and it's on Netflix. And that's an ensemble drama centered around the hit and run of a young black teenager by a white cop. Okay, Veena,
yes.
Could you tell us why you chose today to talk about Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window?
I was steeped in Hitchcock as a kid. I grew up in a house with zero censorship. My parents allowed me to watch everything as a very young, small child.
That's nice.
All of Hitchcock, even The Exorcist. Nothing was verboten in my household for some reason. I'm not 100% sure why. But those were my first memories of watching film.
Mm-hmm.
And Rear Window, the whole entire Hitchcock oeuvre, I would love to talk about. And there's so many kind of influences. But certainly Rear Window stood out, especially for our conversation today, because it's so much about voyeurism. It's so much about, you know, the position of the writer in constructing stories, looking out at the world, making things up.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, mysterious, dark, terrible things that may occur outside.
Yeah, girl,
your own,
you get dark.
You know.
And we will be talking about that darkness for sure.
Okay.
And, you know, where that comes from and how you channel it into stories. For those who haven't seen Rear Window, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that should not stop you from listening before you watch. My motto, as always, is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and peep Rear Window first, this is your chance. Now, let's introduce Rear Window. Here's a quick synopsis for you. Written by John Michael Hayes and directed by Alfred Hitchcock, Rear Window stars Jimmy Stewart as Jeffries, a world-class photographer who's laid up in his New York apartment with a broken leg. All he has to keep him busy are his binoculars, which he uses to spy on all of his neighbors. Meanwhile, his girlfriend Lisa, played by Grace Kelly, is a cosmopolitan fashion model and woman about town. She wants Jeffries to commit to her, but he finds her posh way of life quite boring and longs to go on assignment to far-reaching places. As the two circle around the future of their relationship, Jeffries gets extremely interested in the man across the way, played by Raymond Burr, who argues with his wife, and then one day the wife is poof, gone. Jeffries can't get it out of his mind that he saw the guy leave the apartment and come back 3 times in the rain late at night. When the guy starts packing up and shipping out a trunk from the apartment, Lisa begins to take Jeffrey's worries seriously. Because Jeffrey's can't move, Lisa becomes his personal inspector, even breaking into the apartment to help solve the crime. But the guy catches on to them. What follows is a pretty tense time between a man immobilized by a broken leg and a murderer trying to cover his tracks. That's it in a gist, but so much of this movie is just about texture and, you know, this kind of like slow burn into feeling very, very terrified for this guy in an apartment.
He's very helpless.
Yes, he's extremely helpless.
Yes.
And that's something I think we should talk about is all of the problems that are presented to the writer in this film when he's writing the script, right? Because the problems are, one, the protagonist is in a wheelchair and can't leave his apartment. to the antagonist says something like 10 words in the whole script. And we also only ever see him really in long, wide shots. And then the two don't even stand in the same room until the last moments of the movie. And those could essentially be big problems. But Hayes said that when he was working on this, that it actually became really great to have these parameters. And I was wondering, you know, if we could talk about those kind of parameters in writing. What happens when you have to solve these problems? I mean,
I think sometimes, like in Rear Window, incredible creativity happens. I think that the whole parameter of not being in direct confrontation with the antagonist until the end of the film happens in mysteries many times, mysteries that I love, where the antagonist, you know, the bad guy, is far and away, is you're not sure if it's who exactly the bad guy is. It could be your cousin, it could be the neighbor, it could be, so the bad guy is this elusive force more than a person. And having, you know, the most challenging thing, but also quite juicy, I think, as a writer, is for your hero, in this case, Jimmy Stewart, to be in lockdown and not able to physically go out and do any sort of investigation or interaction. But therein lies the joy of the voyeur, which feels so much like what we do when we sit in front of a screen. You know, we are locked down on our seats. Mm-hmm. We're computing, we're thinking, you know, all this subterranean stuff is happening, you know, as we watch any sort of television. And there's a great almost movie within a movie feel for me to Rear Window.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's the thing where this was adapted from a story. And when Hayes got it, there was no Grace Kelly character. There was no Thelma character. It was just, you know, there was no guy playing the piano.
It was just a lonely man looking out the window.
Exactly, exactly. Which, you know, definitely could not fly as a movie or anything, which I find, you know, like out of necessity, they kind of develop these characters. And
absolutely. Yeah. In on the screen, you need someone to talk to. Unlike when you can go kind of into the interior space of a character in a short story or novel, you know, obviously in movies and TV, you can't. And so in order to articulate anything that's going on inside a character, you need another human being, you know, or, you know, a volleyball, you know, like Tom Hanks did in the Island movie.
Yes.
You need some person that you can translate what's going on inside your mind to. So I completely understand the need to create more characters, both those women in his life, so that he could articulate the fears and the suspicions, et cetera.
One of the things that happens, you know, in, you know, mysteries or, you know, any your shows, all of them, is that the creator has to decide which like point of view the audience is going to be in. Are we going to be with both, you know, the killer and the person trying to solve the crime? Are we just with like the quote unquote detective? Here, I think this one is really interesting because in Rear Window, we are mostly only with Jimmy Stewart until one moment, you know, like halfway through the movie where he falls asleep and we get to see something that he's not privy to, which I think that was a fascinating choice, you know, that we get to have like a little bit a jump ahead of the information that he has to figure out. But I think that must be a really big decision to have to make when you're making a show. 7 seconds, for instance, you get to know the people who committed the crime as well as the people who are solving it.
Right. And that was a new challenge because in The Killing, you know, we, the audience, like the detectives, did not know who the killer was until the very end. In 7 seconds, we, the audience, know far more than the prosecutor and the homicide detective does as they kind of go down this path trying to discover who killed Brent Butler. That was a wonderful challenge to say, we know the crime, we know the players, we know the bad guys. What lies beneath that?
Mm-hmm.
What motivates an action? What are the consequences for the antagonist because of that action? How does his moral compass become obliterated, you know, in the wake of having left a child to die in the snow? Mm-hmm. And examining that, it was almost like, and totally not to sound completely pretentious, but the joys of Crime and Punishment, the joys of being able to be in the internal world of someone whose sense of self is completely falling apart.
Yes.
So that was one kind of world to explore and mire ourselves in. And then, of course, you know, detective and prosecutor and their personal stories, kind of their internal obstacles about self and worth and, you know, how they're treated by the outside world being the obstacles that prevent them from moving forward, in addition to whatever the bad cops were throwing in their way.
Yeah.
And then the family, you know, who are just left with the brokenheartedness of having lost a child, and then how that inspires the mom to start looking for who killed her son.
Do you think, I mean, did you make 7 Seconds in a way to respond to maybe having frustrations with the killing where you couldn't go into those stories? Or
it wasn't so much frustrations. It was because I write in this genre, what can I do that's different? What
yeah.
can I do that's new? Like, to just repeat is boring for me, you know, as a writer. I'm always looking to try something different that is challenging and hard, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So, you know, me with a whole bunch of writers, let's get together and figure this out.
Yeah.
With the killing, what I was going to kind of mention too is what I love about this genre and why I constructed The Killing the way I did was because the bad guy ultimately, you knew all along.
Mm-hmm.
All along, that person was in the world and was giving clue after clue after clue as to, shall I say, the gender for those who have not watched it yet.
Just say
reasons. And I love this genre the most where it, when it's not so much cat and mouse,
mm-hmm.
but when it's the darkness is inside the room that you're in, the darkness is inside your head, the darkness is inside the person you love, that look, you know, haha, you don't even know who that person is. That kind of shock, terror, coming to grips with what was in front of you the whole time
mm-hmm.
is when I find the genre very, very satisfying. So with that, you know, having done that in The Killing, I said, what would it feel like if we all knew the truth from the very top?
Yeah. How can you make us squirm a little bit more, Vina?
In this dark room.
I mean,
that we're in.
This all has to do with, like, the creating of a villain, too. And one of the things that I really liked the writer of the Rear Window Hayes said is, quote, writers sometimes habitually overdo it in how their characters move, act, and depict themselves. Grand flourish in a villain works for Bond movies, I suppose. But in the world and you and I live in, true villains don't act as such, at least not on any level you or I may have experienced. There's a form of everyday villainy that is largely forgotten now in cinema, and that's what audiences can align best with, what it is they see and know in everyday life.
Mm.
And that's something that I think is infused in Raymond Burr's character, which, you know, even though we don't really get to hear him speak, there's kind of a normalcy about him. He's just the guy across the way who's got a wife and they're not getting along.
Right.
You know, and if, like, upon, like, the first viewing of this movie, I think I even remember it where I was like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to pay more attention to this story because, you know, we're seeing these unfold in multiple windows across the way.
Yeah.
And you're not quite sure which one is going to have the importance. So it's just kind of a crapshoot. Like, which one is it?
Right. It's like those things that we had with kids where you could open. It was like that cardboard
yes.
castle, and you opened the different windows and there's different scenarios behind it. Absolutely. I mean, especially during that time, there was probably mustache twirling villains. But I can understand yeah. the writer's dilemma, because if we knew from the very beginning, and if Jimmy Stewart knew, the story would be over within the first 15 minutes.
Yes.
So to not know, and to also, from what I remember that I loved about the Stewart character, going insane, you know, thinking that, am I seeing things? Am I not? Am I just going cabin fever? You know, am I just frustrated? Do I have too much pressure from, you know, being, being married or not being married, or what should I do about this relationship? So this sense of escapism, you know, am I making this up because I'm bored out of my mind, you know, or I'm uncomfortable as shit, you know, and I want to have this fantasy world. A man who had who's traveling and he broke his leg when he was on the racetrack. And that's why he was in, you know, the cast. Am I unable to sit still and just look out the window at my neighbors? I remember, though, the film, you know, to this day, when I look out a window, whether it's in my neighborhood here in L.A. or when I was living on the East Coast, I always wonder if I'm going to catch something that I shouldn't have seen.
And you have a dark brain,
too. Will the killer come up to my
That's the writer in you.
Yeah, that's the damage from Hitchcock when you're like 5 years old.
I think all kids should watch Hitchcock when they're like 5 years old. Just be ready, because you may catch a killer. Someone might try to kill you. That's just, you know, it's good primer material. We're going to take one quick break, and then I'm going to come back and we'll talk about the relationship between Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly's character and what their relationship is with the people across the way. Okay, one quick break.
You never know who you'll run into in Fairhaven, the city under the bubble.
Allison Becker.
Eliza Skinner.
Keith Powell.
Mucus-drenched imp monsters.
Rob Corddry.
Christelle Alonso.
Judy Greer.
Grotesquely possessive carnivorous plants.
Justin McElroy.
Travis McElroy.
Griffin McElroy.
Terrifying, malevolent, sentient beards.
John Hodgman.
Paul F. Tompkins.
Lisa Loeb.
Bubble, the sci-fi comedy from MaximumFun.org. Just open your podcast app and search for Bubble.
Hey, welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here with Vina Sood today talking about Rear Window. Let's introduce Grace Kelly into this conversation, because she's phenomenal in this film. She was working on Dial M for Murder when Hitchcock was working on the script with Hayes. And, you know, her performance in this, I think, is on a it's cultivated, I think. She gets to play a more fun version of herself. Hayes based this character on partially his wife, and who was a high fashion model, very jet set, and then also on Grace Kelly, who he spent 5 days with just to get to know her, to really try to infuse her personality in what he thought she could excel at saying, you know, the dialogue that she would just kill. And so he came up with this person, and, you know, she's a perfect idealized version of a woman that for some reason Jimmy Stewart just won't fucking marry.
Goodbye, Jeff.
Well, you mean goodnight.
I mean what I said.
Well, Lisa, couldn't we just keep things status quo?
Without any future.
Well, when am I going to see you again?
Not for a long time. At least, not until tomorrow night.
And even as a young girl, I called bullshit on that. I knew that, come on. Yeah, that was the one part of the film that I definitely felt frustrated and annoyed about, because, come on, Grace Kelly, that's, yeah. There's no problem with making a decision whether or not you're going to marry her, Jimmy.
Well, one of the things that, you know, we see with this movie is those people across the way. Each one is a bit of a mirror of Jimmy Stewart's story and thought process, because he's afraid of getting married. He's afraid of commitment. He's afraid of this woman. And so you've got different people kind of representing different stages of this. You've got the newlywed couple who's in love, which is like, yes, get married. You've got the older couple with the dog who are like arguing all the time, like bickering, trying to get the mattress off of the fire escape. You've got the young woman, like a dancer, who Jimmy Stewart's character says is basically like Lisa. And then you have a guy who murdered his wife. And so he's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't get married. You know, like, this is his, like, what his anxieties are about getting married are actually getting played for him across the way. It's almost like his own thought process. And I think that mirroring happens a lot in stories. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, mirroring, because you're trying to bring out one character's story. So you might put something into, you know, another person's story, or might, you know, have some kind of symbolism in another story that you have. Do you do that in your work, or...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great observation about Rear Window. In 7 Seconds, there is a prosecutor who's the lead, who's the heroine of the story, K.J. Harper.
And who's played by the fabulous
Claire Hope
Ashady.
Yeah. And she is an alcoholic. She's a woman who has bottomed out in terms of where she thinks her purpose in life is. And here comes, you know, the case of the century, unbeknownst to her, with the Brenton Butler murder. And what I did in terms of partnering a character like that with a character like Fish, played by Michael Mosley, the way I described it, and we talked about in the room, the writers, two people who on the outside are losers. Mm-hmm. You know, he's been, his wife cheated on him. He's the joke of, you know, NYPD, his station that he worked in. He's fled to New Jersey to kind of leave that shame. He lives with a bunch of dogs. Like, he has decided and he's decided to kind of shut out life, you know, and his own daughter doesn't want to, you know, live with him anymore. Life has passed him by. And in the same way that life is about to pass her by, like, this is her last chance to actually matter, to stand up and say the truth and do the right thing. Both these characters were absolutely essential to see each other's primal fault without ever articulating it, but then also to Fish keeps hounding her, you know, throughout the whole season, calls her a coward, calls her a sellout. You know, he goes to the jail cell and he's like, fucking tell it to the kid. Tell it to this dead kid anymore that you're giving up. I'm done hearing it.
Yeah.
And that type of person who understands how terrifying it is to lose and lose and lose and lose over and over again is the only person who can speak to her. Again, without over-articulating kind of who I am, who you are, we're the same, we're different, I'm always interested in those pairings because I feel that there is a fascinating relationship between men and women that go beyond falling in love and beyond romance. And I've never, you know, even with Lyndon and Holder in The Killing, the series ended a very specific way with their relationship. But from the start, you know, I was very, very clear, this is not going to be a romantic relationship. This is not going to be, you know, titillating, should they, shouldn't they? Because I feel men and women, like in real life, relate on so many interesting and different levels that are not necessarily romantic or sexual.
Yeah.
And if we only are allowed to see those images, it expands the world for all of us. And I think anyway, in real life, like, come on, you know, we're not all sleeping with our coworkers, you know.
Wait, what? One thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was the fact that a lot of people credit Hitchcock for doing everything in his movies, but he didn't. it's just that
that's another shocker.
Yeah, it's one of those things where when I was growing up, I was just like, yes, Hitchcock. In my head, he was like shooting it, he was like scoring it, he wrote it, you know, like marketing, he did all of it. And I think that he wanted people to believe that. But Hayes, who worked with Hitchcock on 3 other pictures after this, some of his best, might I add, like those two men, you know, they came up with this stuff together in a collaborative fashion, but apparently Hitchcock would not allow anyone to really know that he didn't write it himself, you know? Wow. Like, he didn't get the credit, but he told everyone that he
a
did
film
it.
By.
Yeah. Yes. Whereas Hayes was much more likely to say, like, no, we collaborated, you know? It wasn't just me. It wasn't just him. I was writing it, and we collaborated.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's this lone wolf kind of romanticization of the auteur. And on one hand, I fully understand the idea of one person having to shepherd something through. I think that's absolutely true on television, but it is absolutely a village. It's writers, you know, working with the creator. It's all your editors. It's, you know, obviously production cast, consultants. It is absolutely a village. And for me, with The Killing and with 7 Seconds, everything was found together, you know, especially in the writer's room, especially in edit. You know, 3 times I had an idea, went in the writer's room, found something new, went on set, found something new with the actors, went to edit, found something new, you know, with post. So there was always this idea of what I feel absolutely fortunate that I've had so many brilliant people working on my shows, yet somehow I'm just the only one being given credit as showrunner. It's bizarre, and I feel that culture exists in films as well. That it's directed by a film by, you know, versus crediting a writer, giving substantial enough credit to a writer who came up with the idea in the first place.
We want to believe in geniuses.
Yeah,
at least I mean, I don't now, but I think that maybe a human tendency to want to believe that there are otherworldly super beings out there. You know, not that Hitchcock is not, you know, he wasn't like phenomenally hugely talented and also an abusive man, but that, you know, it wasn't just him. It was, you know, his wife, his collaborators, his daughter at times, you know, people who fed into all of this.
Yeah.
But when Hitchcock was making this movie, he, I believe, said in an interview that this was kind of a boring thing to make. Everything went off without a hitch, pun intended. And, you know, they had worked on the script so, so hard, and they broke it down to 600 different shots. Like, they knew exactly which shots were going to work with this, because the screenwriter and the director are actively, you know, reworking the script for everything that could ever occur for the camera, for the sound design, for any of that. And so they went in with kind of no shockers, you know. It's just everyone had an idea of what was going on. It was the exact map. They shot on the Paramount soundstage. They cut the floor out of the soundstage so they could make the set.
I love how much you know about this. It's incredible.
It's fun.
It's fascinating.
That's another thing. I mean, like, have you ever thought about doing something on a soundstage, like how that would be different from working, you know, on these on-location things that you've worked on before?
Yeah. It's so interesting that you brought up the discipline in terms of shot choreography with Rear Window, because I see the challenge of that. There is no break in the visual landscape. There's no breath. So in order to visually not feel repetitive and boring, I absolutely understand how he had to choreograph everything and choreograph it like a dance. So shot after shot after shot of the window in the bedroom. I mean, there's only so many angles because the camera never went into the apartment.
No, because we did was kind of a
pure voyeurism.
Like, he would bring his camera with the long lens, and so we would get like a long lens shot,
right? Which is
through the windows.
It's magnificent if you think about the architecture of this film. You know, we've shot on stages before. I just directed my first film, and a great part of it.
That's not in the bio. You didn't give me that in a bio.
It just happened.
Okay.
It's a very quiet, simple story about a teenage girl who accidentally kills her best friend, and her parents cover it up. They make this terrible decision in a moment of panic to cover it up. Most of the movie takes place inside their house over the course of 5 days.
Yeah.
And we had to be extremely meticulous in thinking how to shoot that house, because we are in the kitchen 100 times. We're in the bedroom 100. We're in the same physical place. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know, a castle in, you know, medieval Europe. It's a house, you know, with a friggin', you know, sink. And so and especially with mystery and especially with the genre, how do you create ominous dread, you know, in a house that is in suburbia? Over the course of the entire movie. So ditto, the Greenwich Village apartment where Jimmy Stewart lived, creating dread using different visual devices. I mean, even more difficult because literally in that apartment, in his POV for the entire movie, that had to be, I understand, having to choreograph all of that.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, Vina. It seems like a lot of work. I love that the premise of your movie is also very dark. So I'm like, I would not expect anything like okay, so Vina Sood's just going to do a romantic comedy? No. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to get back into, you know, the things that obsess us as writers. Okay, one quick break.
Hey, everybody. Hal Lublin and Mark Gagliardi from We Got This here to talk about our upcoming live shows.
Why don't you tell everybody the details about our show in Philadelphia?
Sure. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go down to Philadelphia Improv Theater, okay? I'm going to do it on Saturday, June 23rd, okay? There are two shows. One is 5 o'clock show. There's an 8 o'clock show. At 8 o'clock show, you can get a VIP ticket and hang out with us at 7 p.m. for like a whole hour. We'll sign something for you. You can hang out. You can talk to us. And then come see a show. Both shows are going to be completely different, though.
Both shows?
Both shows are going to be different.
Here's like a British actor trying to do a Philadelphia accent.
Yeah. You can look up Philadelphia Podcast Festival. You can look that up and get tickets there. Or you can go to Philadelphia Improv Theater, to the FIT Theater, P-H-I-T, and you can get tickets there. Or you can just go direct at bit.ly/WeGotPhilly2018. That's WEGOTPHILLY 2018.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here today with Vina Sood talking Rear Window. Okay, so I am curious to know what you think about music in film. The music for this is actually, this film for Rear Window is really, really risky, especially it was risky at that time because he didn't have a traditional score. The music that we hear is essentially sound design of a city and of a courtyard and a garden and of neighbors. And of the music kind of coming from their windows, but specifically music coming from a pianist's window because he's attempting to compose a song that from beginning to end of the movie, you know, like that's the sound of it, is someone not quite getting the pieces, not quite putting the pieces together and getting really frustrated. Mm. And that's kind of the feeling that we also have, is a song that's not quite right until the song becomes right. And that's, you know, I think it's a really beautiful and risky thing to do in a piece of media. And do you think about music a lot when you're writing? Do you try not to think about it too much because, you know, like maybe you don't have as much control over it? What is your job when you're doing, you know, with TV or with this movie that you made too?
For me, the aspiration, and again, I think storytelling is built on layers and it changes from script to pre-production to production to post and becomes different and refined from how it was originally conceived. But whether it's a TV show or this film, always starts out in utter silence. Mm. So there's nothing from the quote unquote outside world that comes in. It's all what are the foundation, what are the building blocks, are the people, first of all, you know, who is Latrice Butler, who is, you know, Isaiah Butler, who from 7 Seconds, who is KJ Harper, who are they? Like in the writer's room, we would always talk about characters in terms of what is their organizing principle. So what's the one thing, if we had to boil a character down, what's the one thing that this person is about? And we spend a lot of time just talking about that before we even let them do things, before we create plot. Mm-hmm. So it's a very kind of simple, skeleton at the beginning of a story, and I'm not thinking about music all the way until post. And in post, then comes the act of sitting back and witnessing what has been done with all the pieces.
Yeah.
And then it's, you know, then I become, I mean, of course, you know, the composer for the most part has been hired beforehand off of instincts, off of how ideas of how the score might live in this piece. But I have to say, you know, again, you know, another thing to wildly admire about Hitchcock, and maybe that's why, you know, he is one of my biggest influences, you know, not only because I was influenced as a child, but is the daring and the riskiness and the audacity to just do things differently and to use what's in the environment, because we don't want the audience disconnecting. Like, that's what I feel as when I watch material, is the little things disconnect me. You know, if someone's house is too clean and they've got three kids, I'm gone.
Do you have any examples of times when you just like...
Gone! Well, not specific ones, but I feel like there was a whole slate of films that were coming out in the 90s where, you know, it was like a lot of family breakfast scenes.
Yeah.
And, you know, mom would show up and pancakes were being flipped and kids would be quippy and dad would be reading the paper. And in the chaos, having a child myself, in the chaos of all of this, you know, young parenthood, mom's hair is perfect, the house is like impeccable, and the pancakes are delicious. And I was like, this absolutely does not reflect my life or anyone's life I know. Like,
yes.
I can barely put a granola bar in my son's mouth before he goes to school. I'm a terrible mother. But the juncture by which we disconnect is probably true for the filmmaker too. Like, I will just start disconnecting to my own work if I start to see the seams, if I start to realize that wall on the set has been painted. Like, I know there's no fingerprints. And so in 7 seconds, when we were at, you know, it's a Jersey City hospital based on a real hospital that used to be in Jersey City that I used to go to. My son had a daycare center at the bottom of it. It was a very old, it was almost like a haunted place. And it was terrifying. And the set designer, the production designer, and I walked through, and Gavin, who directed the pilot, and literally had people put stuff on their hands and touch the walls,
mm-hmm.
you know, oil, and touch the windows, because that's how real life looks, you know?
Yeah.
We've got fingerprints and dirty little things all over the place. And on sets, that doesn't, because it's built and it's new. And
yes.
I feel that, you know, and it drives me insane. And even with the killing in the pilot, Patty Jenkins, who directed it, Patty and I, you know, she, you know, had a kid too, who was very young when we were doing the pilot. And we know what it's like when you've got kids. This woman's lost her daughter. She's got two young kids. And so before we started shooting, we went on the kitchen set of the Larson's house and put our hands in the cereal boxes, pulled our hands out, left the cereal boxes with that kind of crummy, you know, unfolded stuff at the top, and walked around, like, eating shit and dropping shit. And no one picks it up in real life unless you have a dog, you know, or
yeah.
someone to clean your house. You know, a lot of stuff just stays in the corners.
Yeah. And that's like the texture that you're adding to this picture, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just to the how it looks, but just to the story.
And I'm not sure how I got to crumbs on a kitchen counter off of composers and music, but somehow
it's a beautiful trajectory. But, you know, speaking of those details, we do have, you know, huge set that they had to build, you know, for Rear Window. And yet it does feel lived in. Like, I know that it's artificial. I know that. I can feel that. I understand. But there's enough of the little details around that make me feel like it is lived in. Jimmy Stewart's apartment is not impeccably clean.
Right.
You know?
Like,
things are just kind of tossed around.
Right.
Of course, he's got, like, sipping bourbon or something. Or I can't remember.
And the women just come and clean up.
Exactly. You know, and his pajamas are kind of cut weirdly. They look like they were cut like last minute to fit the cast in them.
Right.
It's just like the little things that make you feel that it's real, even though it clearly is not.
Right. I mean, what an odd thing we do, right? We walk into like this big giant building. We know it's a movie. We know it's all made up. We know these are actors and we're eating popcorn. We know. And then there's this moment where we are crying and screaming and running, and our marriages change and the trajectory of our lives change because of a thing that's not real. So it has to become real.
Humans are insane. We are insane. Why do we do this? God, why do we care? I don't know. It's weird. If I stop and think about it, I'd probably quit my job because it's too weird to think about. One thing I did want to hit before, you know, we kind of wrap things up is just the working with certain actors. You know, even though you weren't specifically directing on the TV show, you know, with your role as showrunner, you still have a very, I would assume, tight connection to who's in it, why they're in it. And we have this movie Rear Window, which is, you know, a collection of some of the greatest collaborators that Hitchcock had in his movies. Grace Kelly and Jimmy Stewart were his favorite people. I mean, Grace Kelly because of her beauty and kind of brains and, you know, ability to kind of play with the boys, quote unquote. And then Jimmy Stewart for being an everyman who could kind of fit into anything, any character, anywhere. And apparently I was told, I was reading some interviews and stuff, that he also carried a copy of the script with him every single place that he went.
Hmm.
Like he treated it as his Bible. So if you saw him, he always had a copy of the script with him. So he cared about that a great deal, which of course Hitchcock loved.
Mm-hmm.
And you've worked with a lot of great actors. Why would you work with these people again? Like, how do you decide who's going to be the one? You know, how did you decide that Claire Hope Ashaty is going to be in 7 Seconds as KJ, or Regina King as well? You know, two great actresses that you've pulled
great
into this.
Actresses. I knew from the beginning when I wrote the character of Latrice Butler, a woman who loses her son, that Regina King was my choice. Phenomenal actress. I followed her work for many years, and it's a tough burden to carry. Playing the role, going through the emotions as long as an actress has to, 6 months while we're shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Regina has a son, and to imagine and have to step through and have your body go through the experience of that is deeply, deeply, deeply. It costs a lot. I know that happens for actors. It's asking them a lot, to do a lot, you know, including Russell Hornsby, who plays her husband.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I had to have, you know, I the way I described it is Regina is a force of nature and Russell is the pillars of the earth. Like, I had to have these actors who were so extraordinarily big that they could take something like this, honor, serve it. Because again, there's leaning into it every moment. There's no walking away, looking away for either of the parents, because that's what happens in real life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to honor that truth for parents who've lost their children, especially in this situation, you know, with all the police violence that's happening in our country today.
Mm-hmm.
Not take an easy way out of that, making ourselves and the audience look at that in a deep and profound way, and really understanding what is the cost of a child's life in America today. So I needed these magnificent human beings who could show up every day, do that. I know it cost them. We had many conversations over the course of shooting. It was hard. It was really, really hard. There was a moment at the end of episode 2 that Jonathan Demme directed, that episode where Latrice Butler comes into the hospital room. Her son has survived the hit and run.
Mm-hmm.
There's hope that he will come out of the coma eventually. The family's in a really great place because all of us know who've had a sick child or a child in the hospital that it's such a – there's nothing like having hope when your child is in danger. And she goes to the cafeteria. The only time she's left the room, her son's room, over the course of many days to get a piece of apple pie. And she comes back and her son is dead. And he's passed away in her absence. And Regina did an extraordinary thing. And she sat down next to, you know, her son's body, the young actor who was playing Breton, and she wept. And Jonathan never cut. Like, Jonathan just kept rolling and rolling and rolling. And what I saw there was a woman going into acceptance, into grief, into this abyss, and the bravery of the actress, the bravery of the director to just keep going, keep going, keep going. And I remember watching the first cut and thinking, okay, you know, the convention in many screens is after the tears start, you cut. And we didn't, you know. Mm-hmm. And that powerful, I think, that moment is all the more powerful because we stayed with her. Because she's got nowhere to go. We should stay with her too. So I needed a woman like Regina. Claire was a find. Claire was just this incredible stroke of the universe saying, keep going. Mm-hmm. We were, and I feel like this happens a lot with a lot of my leads. It happened with Mireille Unos, who played the lead of The Killing.
She didn't show up at your doorstep. She was, like, delivering pizza. Yeah. She was like, hi.
And I was like, you're the one. like Mireille, Claire, we were already in pre-production. We were already, directors in both cases were already, Patty was in Vancouver about to shoot the pilot of The Killing. Gavin was in New York about to shoot the pilot of 7 Seconds. And we did not have our leads. And in Claire's case, we were seeing actresses from everywhere, L.A., Europe, Australia, you know, Canada. And I was so exhausted and so despairing at one point. I went home, and instead of doing any work, I was just like, fuck it. I'm turning on the television. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Oh, my God. We're going down. We can't find our lead actress. Turn on the television and Children of Men.
No way, because we're talking about Children of Men on another episode. We're in a... I'm so happy that you're bringing that up, because that's going to be a nice segue into the next one,
yeah.
too. She's so good in that.
She's so good in that. And I literally looked up and I said, thank you. That's her. And she came and read, and it was her.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Oh, we love her on this show. We do love her. I want to thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about Rear Window and 7 Seconds and The Killing and this other mystery movie that you didn't tell me about. and thank you again for being here and for making me rewatch this movie.
Thank you so much. Thanks for all your knowledge about the movie. It's incredible.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Next week, we'll be talking to writer, actor, producer Cleopatra Coleman. You may know her as Erica on Last Man on Earth, one of my favorite shows. But she'll be on to discuss Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men and her new feature, Hover, which she wrote and starred in. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. And by will, I mean I'll. Burn Munn says, I actually edit 30 to 60,000 word interviews for my day job, and so I mean it when I say Wolf is one of the best interviewers I've ever listened to. Plus, her guests are great, and I've learned about some incredible movies. Thank you. Thank you, Burn Munn. And thank you for calling me by my last name, because that's what most people usually call me by. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group, too. I mean, you've got time, right? Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.